that I myself was not to show that photo. So, Ned, thank you for outing me. It is difficult for me to express my thanks for this honor in adequate terms to all of you. This truly was not expected. During my residency, one of my distant past mentors, Dr. Robert Petersdorf, then director of the chief of internal medicine at the University of Washington, was holding rounds in a room of about 30 or so residents, and the team who was in primary care of the patient being discussed had to be called out of the room on some reason. So when RGP asked a certain question, I answered it, and he assumed, therefore, that I was in charge of the case, and I said, so he then asked a follow-up question I didn't know the answer to, and I said, I'm just your humble gastroenterology resident. And he said, hand sealed, I will buy a GI resident. Humble? No way. But I do feel humble in this circumstance, and I appreciate it. I think recognition in a scientific realm by one's professional peers is the highest professional honor that that exists, and I appreciate it greatly. I read most of the parent, probably 15 or so of the last several, 20 or so parent award lectures published in sexually transmitted diseases. Rich Rothenberg pointed out a few years ago that the reflection on a lifetime career achievements means that a lifetime has passed, which is a time and a cause for reflection. It's not always the case. King Holmes got his parent award at age 40. But in general, it certainly applies to me. Larry Corey commented that this is a time for a real speech and not just another lecture. And in fact, this is going to be pretty much a data-free presentation. I've got some slides, but they're simply to help me make some notes to comment and keep my thoughts to you. So what I'm going to do with you the next 45 minutes or so, maybe only half an hour off that, is talk about a little bit of history to give you some context. The title of my talk, Stones Unturned, Missed Opportunities, will then provide the bulk of the information that I'll discuss with you. And then I'll give some acknowledgement and thanks to all of you in the largest sense and to a number of you in particular. So why is it worth, and is it just ego for me to stand up and tell you a little bit about not only my past history, but how this all came to pass? I hope that's not the only reason. I think we all understand the principle that understanding where we come from and the maintenance of institutional memory can help us formulate where we're going in the future. And that ideal is really on my mind when I bring this up. My career spans, I would say, the entire period of the most exciting, rapid evolution of STD sciences that have existed in history. Now, you can say that of a lot of fields, many areas of microbiology, infectious diseases, cancer therapy, and so on, certainly have also seen their most dramatic gains in history in the last 30 years. But it has been 35 years. I'm sorry? A little closer. I do apologize. In fact, I'm just going to hold it, which will make it easier. Thank you, Jenny. 1971, I finished my residency and began my fellowship with King as King Holmes' second fellow at the University of Washington. At that time, the nation was experiencing what was characterized as a dramatic gonorrhea epidemic. The notion of other STDs sort of in the background, but it was a gonorrhea epidemic. STD clinics, the very notion of mid-level practitioners was just beginning to evolve. The vast majority of STD clinics were peopled by RMs, licensed practical nurses, and in many cases, the care for males was being provided by public health advisors, as we called them then, disease intervention personnel now, who were sort of trained on the fly with an hour or so of watching a doctor do some stuff, take a few usual swabs, and there they and then they became the clinician deliverers. In other clinics, were peopled by retired urologists or others who were, in some cases, not the best and not and were looking to end a career and not to think critically. The state of science had been dominated for 50 or 60 years by observational approaches that did not meet what today we would understand are the standards for clinical and epidemiologic research. There was a dermatologic focus, which is not bad, dermatology is great, but it happened as the new gonorrhea epidemic was evolving that for the first time, some people whose primary interests were microbiology and infectious diseases began to get involved. So King Holmes, Fred Sparling at University of North Carolina, and a number of others on the ground floor in the very earliest days. And in those early days, as it took a few years from the late 60s as the rising gonorrhea rates began to be appreciated and approached toward the peak that later came in the middle 1970s, a sense of alarm developed and money began to become available. But there weren't very many places available or with the interest and capability to use that those funds in a way that was scientifically credible. That's really the reason why a few selected places became so dominant in STD research. There's nothing magic about Seattle except for the luck of having a King Holmes and some other folks who were able to take these new resources and run with them almost in an uncompetitive fashion. In the 1974 meeting of the Interscience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, there was the first ever STD specific session at an ICAC meeting. There were 8 presentations, and 6 of the 8 papers were presented by me and others of our colleagues at the University of Washington at that time. That was also to tell a little bit of a personal story about one of my mentors, Marvin Turk, who at that time my parents lived in La Jolla, California, and I had grown up in Garden City, New York, and ICAC was in Atlantic City. And so my mom came to hear me speak on asymptomatic gonorrhea and introduced me to Marv Turk. And Marvin said, "Well, Mrs. Hansfield, this is a real pleasure because I really wanted to meet you." "Why is that?" "Because Hunter is the only Gentile I know with a Jewish mother, and I really wanted to meet you." And she looked somewhat puzzled. "What do you mean?" He said, "Only a Jewish mother would travel from La Jolla, California to Atlantic City, New Jersey to hear her son talk about gonorrhea." During those early years were a time when a fellow, having had 2 years of training with King, Paul Wiesner, his first fellow, came directly out of the fellowship to CDC to head the Division of STD Prevention. So this is somebody who was where I was 30 years ago, came to head the division. And I think it began, I think, the era of that same sort of scientific, if not overtly academic, a scientific, modern scientific epidemiologic approach to understanding STD prevention here in Atlanta. I then spent some time in the Navy, a year at University of California, Irvine, went into private practice. And actually that did, I think, give me a little bit of perspective on things. But by the end of a couple years in private practice, number one, I missed STDs. Number two, I missed Seattle. Number three, CDC was just starting to create what became the network of national STD HIV prevention training centers. And under that influence, the Seattle King County Public Health Department, in the first time with a joint recruitment with the University of Washington, induced me, without having to argue very hard, to return to Seattle. And when I came back then in 1978, I was now immersed again in an extremely dynamic environment. So now came through the training program and overlapping with with me in my early now faculty years were Dave Martin, Larry Corey, Tom Quinn, Judy Wasserheit, Peter Piot, Peter Cole, Ned Hook, Sheila Lukart, and I could go on, but I don't have to go much further to impress on you the quality of thinking and intellectual ferment that was going on at that time. Not long thereafter, after a little bit of glimmer of thinking about behavioral science, the behavioral status of STD prevention in those days was use condoms, don't do that unless you're using condoms, and to show frightening pictures of penises falling off and other horrible sorts of things. We now know that those don't work. Bill Darrow and soon afterwards Seb Ural began to teach us a little bit about the lack of insight that those sort of approaches implied. But we didn't do much about it. We believed, and all of my energies were in this microbiology infectious diseases realm. We can deal with these problems with technical science. Then AIDS came along. And all of a sudden, we learned that R sub O equals beta CD, the transmission paradigm, which is now almost a cliche, it comes up so often for you, that if you think about it, beta, the efficiency of transmission, is essentially a biomedical intervention. D, the duration of infection, can be influenced biomedically for some infections. You can shorten the average duration of a gonococcal or chlamydial infection by getting people treated more promptly than otherwise. But C, the notation, the representation of the rate of partner change, the rate at which uninfected people come into contact with people who are capable of transmitting the infection, is purely behavioral. And we also began to learn that getting beta to work, to reduce the efficiency of transmission through condom use and that sort of thing, had its own behavioral elements. So if I had to characterize the shift in paradigm and thinking of my own approach and understanding to our specialty, and one that I would encourage all of you to think very seriously about, it is the absolute centrality of understanding the determinants of human behavior at a sociological population level as well as an individual level and then doing something about it. And it isn't just the behavior of people who are at risk for catching infections. The whole notion of the whole domain of translational research, and I've spent my whole career, as Ned implies, hoping to find ways to take effective prevention research into program. That's what T2 translational research is. Remember, T1 translational research is immediate bench to bedside. We have a new diagnostic test. We know it works in the laboratory. Let's see if it works in patients, and it does. That's T1. T2 is taking those policies and making them work. Look at the notion of routine HIV testing or testing uptake. CDC from the very beginning, and I'll talk more about this in a little bit, the very first guidelines on HIV testing said routine opt-out should be the norm, back in 1986. Now, operationally, a bunch of things were done that were thought to be facilitators of improved testing. Counseling, proper consent, understand the meaning of test result, give results in person, use as a teachable moment, and so on. What changed years later is not that that was wrong. It probably was right for the time. And I'll talk about translation, I'll talk about HIV exceptionalism for a few minutes in a little bit. But what was done essentially in the 2006 routine testing recommendations was to recognize that some previous elements that were thought to be facilitators behaviorally, in fact, had evolved into barriers. So we now learned from patients that instead of, at least after the low-hanging fruit had been tested, that they might benefit from testing or not, you know, that they got tested instead of now facilitating testing, the notion of pretest counseling became, I can't get tested unless I'm willing to reveal and discuss my life's innermost secrets. And we now know that routinization helps people get beyond that. If they know they're not being singled out and don't need to reveal that information, testing is more widely accepted. Certainly the acceptance in of nearly universal perinatal testing, antenatal testing, has proved that. So the thunderclap of AIDS was what taught us and taught me to begin to understand the centrality of behavioral science, both at the risk, the person at risk level, and the healthcare delivery behavioral paradigm of providers. So let's go on now and talk about some of these missed opportunities. I found this. I first thought I was pretty proud of myself coming to this idea a couple of months ago. I wasn't going to speak about. When I began to get into it, I began to realize that when you speak of policies we didn't pursue, research projects that we wish we had done, I'm inherently being critical of somebody, including many in this room, who might have been part of the decisions, either de facto or proactively, to not go that way. But nobody should take umbrage. You know, the common phrase, and I can't remember who first quoted, that success has innumerable fathers and failure has only one, really isn't true. Failure, like success, takes a village. These are not individual decisions that were made. They were collective. Some of them were societal. Some of them were institutional. Some of them were influenced by particular individuals. But no person should take umbrage at any particular project that I'll mention that I wish we'd taken a different direction on. I think the other point is to understand that our mental energies, just like our budgets, often operate in a zero-sum game. If we had pursued some of the pathways that I will discuss with you, it's reasonable to ask what pathways that we did pursue might not have been done. Where would we be today with a different set of criticisms had these gone well? So keep that in mind as we go through some of these. What now successful research findings or prevention programs might never have come about. Now, my list of these is purely personal. I did email a number of colleagues, some of whom we'll mention and thanks later, and I got ideas from several folks. There were no surprises. I heard a few things that I hadn't heard from other people, but for the most part, there was a lot of commonality in them, and there are some that I thought of myself. There are a number, I have actually two slides like this, the other one's even longer than this. I will not begin to speak about every one of these in any detail. And as I told you, these are no data. These are just going to talk conceptually about some of these things. And these are not all unalloyed, good or bad, that so on. And all of these have their own reasonable cases that were made at the time. And you'll find that I have essentially two kinds of stones unturned that I look at. One are broad conceptual organizational things. If you jump ahead here to the third red bullet down, national coordination of funding and STE research, I won't have much to say about that except to point out that we do have a problem with the mission of CDC, which is essentially programmatic prevention, which has tiny funding compared with NIH funding, whose mission is not where all of us would necessarily want to put, at least those of us in this room would want to put the bulk of our dollars. So that's a broad conceptual issue, and then I'll also talk mostly on the second slide, I'll touch bases on some specific research initiatives or programmatic issues that we could discuss. So delayed attention to viral STDs. I think most of you, there probably aren't very many surprises in here that don't have broad agreement, at least have some sense of understanding. Hepatitis B, the attention to and prevention of hepatitis B as a sexually transmitted infection. Herpes simplex virus. I think it's fair to say that those of us who have been focused for our careers on preventing STDs tended to look to the treatable diseases. I think it's because people came with the same model that I entered our field with, the biomedical one. I can detect chlamydia pretty easily. I can treat it pretty easily. I can't detect herpes all that well, particularly as we learned the subclinical spectrum. And I can't do a whole lot about, or at least I thought that I couldn't do very much about preventing it. So we tended to look under the lighted lamppost for our lost keys, rather than going off into the dark where the productivity might have been more difficult, but ultimately greater. I would say in the viral STDs, we're doing pretty well on human papillomavirus, thanks in no small part to the work of people in the epidemiology and surveillance branch here at CDC, led by the work of Lori Markowitz in examination of and looking at vaccine, HPV vaccine uptake, and Harold Chesson was recognized in, earlier about his for his contributions in that arena. And I think HIV, of course, made us all sit up and take notice. But I think there was a delay, and I think it's still, and I'm going to talk more specifically about some aspects of herpes prevention in a few minutes. I've already alluded to my shift in thinking about understanding of behavioral determinants and interventions, so I guess I need not dwell on that too much longer at this moment, but it does require critical thinking, and I think even today, although all of us are probably beginning to understand what I've just said, and as I will acknowledge later, much of my learning in this has come directly or indirectly from Sevier Rao, it is that the amount of resources, the amount of critical thinking that's going into this is still very marginal compared to what the need is. And one aspect of it that I'll point out is the whole notion of translational research as its whole evolving institute and so on, NIH, but how much intercourse is there professionally and in terms of communication between the STD prevention world and the translational research world? We're going on separate tracks with similar goals, and I would say with suboptimal integration of those. I already mentioned the issue of national coordination and funding of research, thinking about what we can do to influence, how do we fund those projects that might well be studied by strong science, whether randomized controlled trials or observational research, that you'd hope would be the intellectual domain of NIH, that are beyond the financial resources of CDC, but in some ways are more CDC's purview. How can that be arranged? And I know that Kevin Fenton and John Douglas and Carolyn Deal talk about this. They understand it, they know it, but it's not something that two or three people could just sit down over a glass of wine and figure out what the future ought to be and then make it happen. But we need collectively to see what we can do to move along that track. What about training and nurturing the careers of prevention scientists? You know, early in my training, and when Ned Hook and Judy Wasserheit and Tom Quinn and Dave Martin and others were coming through their training at the University of Washington, King's vision was, we are training people who are going to follow the path that Hansfield took. And a few of us have. But you can count, or even today, you can count on a couple of hands the number of people who, in fact, have followed that sort of pathway of a true integration of academic and public health research. And I would say that we have a system that rewards academic productivity of a kind that gets you first authorships in the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, and more arcane journals like Science or other pathophysiologically oriented research outlets. And that's where our research money comes from. That's what sustains our careers, because we need them to apply for the R01 grants to keep us going. But that's not entirely smoothly compatible with running an STD control program in Newark, New Jersey, or Memphis, Tennessee, or even the other successful places. And Seattle, by the way, is not the only success. Denver was following pretty much the same pathway under Frank Judson's and later John Douglas's and more recently Case Rietmeyer's leadership of exactly the same sort of research clinical integration. And many, many clinics are now doing this. And of course, we're well beyond the minimally trained personnel and so on. But still, you can count on a very small room, the number of people who are going to be exactly the kind of candidates that we want. As John Douglas chooses to move into new directions in his career, how big is the pool of people who we want to encourage to consider that sort of leadership? So I think some thinking should be done about that. How can we train and nurture the careers? At one time, CDC contributed to the support of people like Matt Golden and Jeannie Marazzo and others to spend some time at CDC as part of their training, but that particular program was allowed, perhaps it wasn't truly successful, although some of those individuals were awfully successful, was allowed to wane. Partner management. I won't say a lot about this. I think I'm talking to the choir in people understanding that historically in this country, the vast bulk, and I don't know where the vast bulk, what percentage it comes to, but it's the largest single line item for STD prevention around the country, goes into partner services or things that directly or indirectly support partner services, and yet the quality and frequency and amount of research in how well those things work, there certainly has been some great work. Thank you, Ned, for crediting me on expedited partner therapy, but that was more Matt Golden than it was me. Tom Peterman has been a leader at the SD division in thinking about partner management research. But it's a trivial drop in the bucket compared with understanding how well those resources work and how they can be maximized in their effectiveness. That's another stone unturned, I would say. HIV exceptionalism and the whole notion of HIV prevention is an interesting issue. So, and it's not an unalloyed stone unturned. There are good parts and bad parts, I think, as to how we got where we are in terms of HIV prevention policies based primarily on HIV testing. I, even though the bulk of my career has operationally been in STDs other than HIV/AIDS, my own, in a way, there's bookmarks on my career in this arena. I was privileged to be among the very first consultation group called together by Jim Curran, Harold Jaffe, and others to pull together some national experts to think about whether and how these new blood tests that were being used in blood banking to prevent contamination of the blood supply might be used beyond that purpose in terms of a preventive strategy. In fact, the CDC's first written promotion of HIV testing for the purpose of notifying people of their risk of potential transmitters came not in the 1986 MMWR that specifically addressed that, but in the 1985 STD treatment guidelines. And in that treatment guidelines meeting, Ward Cates has said publicly that I was the first who raised the issue. I don't think I was. There were a number of us. But the notion got discussed then that we should promote, and indeed the 1985 guidelines said that testing for HIV was a good prevention strategy. So that's one bookend very early in my career, and then later I had the opportunity as visiting scientist 2004-2005 here to be John Douglas's representative of the Division of STD Prevention to the work group led by Bernie Branson, who were working on the now promulgated 2006 routine HIV testing guidelines. So I sort of look at that as bookends in my career. I would, an issue on HIV exceptionalism, for those of you who don't know the term, that's Ron Baer has, by the way, I forgot to ask, what are the times, when am I done? I won't talk too much longer. And, what? We want photos and questions, so I'm 10 minutes or so. Okay, yeah, excellent. So the notion of whether we did HIV testing and prevention differently than those of other STDs is clearly true. Some would tell us that that was an unalloyed bad thing to do. And certainly it has had some bad legacies. I would suggest that to the extent that we believed, initially with a little bit fewer data and more hope than reality, that testing and people knowing their HIV status was going to be good. So an overriding goal was to maximize the number of people at risk who knew they were or were not HIV infected. And I would say that the notion of having a holistic informed consent process and written consent was a necessary requirement to achieve high testing rates in the 1980s and into the early part of the 1990s. Things began to change when the cliched low-hanging fruit had been tested, and the people who had not still been tested were inherently more resistant, and we began to learn that in some populations, those facilitators were in fact barriers. And now we move toward a more routine sort of approach, and some have said, Hansfield, you in public health just reversed yourself, you were wrong all along, and now you've seen the light, the way, the truth, and the light. In fact, I would say we collectively made pragmatic decisions about what was going to be best. Now, in this, I think we made some bad decisions as well. I think it was, behavioral scientists would have told us, even without data, psychologists were telling us, and a lot of people believe, that it was more important to find infected people in order to induce them to modify their behavior to protect others. And we now know that there is a, from Marx's meta-analysis, but all the data behind that meta-analysis were published over the years. So we really knew from the start, if you thought it through, that that was biologically a better way to go, that telling someone they were negative, that they should then be equally responsible to protect themselves, A, we now know didn't work. And I think we could have intuited a greater emphasis. In Europe, they did that. They did have the advantage in Europe of watching how things had evolved in the U.S., but from the very start, the emphasis in Scandinavia first, and then Europe was more on prevention and positives, identifying positives, as opposed to using the teachable moment in the negatives, which we now know has a pretty good effect on getting people to report, and probably truly in their minds, to pursue safer behavior. We also know that it has been very difficult to document that that has much effect on actual HIV rates, and although to the extent that we see some positive results from these approaches in STD prevention and Project Respect, the effect is modest and has not been well replicated. Minor mention thing I didn't mention before to show my evolution of thinking on this. In the late 1980s, I was asked to be prepared to apply to CDC because Jack Kirby had inside tracked some money, some of which was going to come to Seattle, to set up a new project to require more space for behavioral interventions. And at the time, I wasn't interested in doing it, didn't do it, and therefore Seattle was not part of Project Respect. So I think the legacy of HIV exceptionalism is having horrible problems in Africa. I think the whole balance between civil rights, the right to know, the right not to know, and testing, I just see as a path I wish had been and could be done a little bit differently. And I'm fully in the camp of Kevin DeCock in his efforts to bring routine HIV testing really to the effective forefront in Africa, which is not still is only in the early stages and not yet as effective as we hope it will be. I would ask the question, if you want to get philosophical, whether a person who is at risk for HIV and whose behaviors are such that there is a reasonable chance that person could transmit the infection, I would submit that that person may not have a right at an ethical level to remain unaware of his or her infection. I think the responsibility to know may outweigh the right to not be tested in that circumstance. That's a controversial statement, but I actually think it's a reasonable thing to think seriously about. Okay, enough on HIV exceptionalism. I'll talk about most of these, go through very quickly. I think we'd all agree, Jeannie is one of the ones whose email said, please say something about our collective failure to assure proper STD assessment evaluation in our HIV care settings. We continue to have a bit of a discrepancy and a dichotomy between those of us providing STD care. I think in the STD world, we do a great job of talking about HIV, testing people for HIV, and so on. I think our brethren in the HIV clinical care world are not doing very well with our half of the paradigm and ways to address that. We have, it's really fascinating to me that 30 years ago, when we learned that 30 to 40% of non-gonococcal urethritis was due to chlamydia, and therefore we knew for sure how to manage the female partners of those men or the partners of women with chlamydia, we now had, okay, we got the other two-thirds of the cases, and nobody has ever done any systematic studies, not one, to look at the clinical spectrum, health outcomes with and without treatment of the female partners of men with non-chlamydial urethritis. We now have M. genitalium in the mix, but you're still talking about half the cases of obscure etiology and an unknown impact on their partner's health. Unknown data on whether or not it prevents reinfection in the index case, whether it has any effect on the partner's outcome. You can make the same case for mucoprevalent cervicitis. At least in bacterial vaginosis, there have been therapeutic studies showing that treatment of men is not very effective in preventing or modifying the natural course in women, but still very little reports on clinical spectrum per se. Ned mentioned the diagnosis and management of early central nervous system syphilis and the fact that it still generates debate. It generates debate because we have not taken the opportunity in terms of force of will, resource, and that sort of thing to find out what is or is not necessary. And in the absence of data, people argue about how they think the world is in ways that could be studied and understood. So we are now left with a dilemma of either spending more money, spending more time, and creating more morbidity from CSF examinations that we may not need, or inducing or allowing excess morbidity to occur. Because the core is not whether there is central nervous system invasion or what you could clinically or bacteriologically or physiologically diagnose as neurosyphilis early in the disease. What is not known is whether treatment differently makes a difference in outcome. And that could be studied, hasn't been, and I find that, you know, it's fairly microcosmic. There aren't very that, you know, syphilis is numerically not that common a problem in this country anymore. Not that I would totally disregard it, but it's frustrating. In the least, that it's a path we haven't followed. I mentioned hepatitis B earlier, and certainly the wholesale failure across the medical professions, with which we are at least in part complicit as a specialty of routinization of hepatitis B immunization. HPV immunization in males has a question mark by it. I actually, until I heard Lori Markowitz's fine presentation yesterday, I was going to talk about this as a potential missed opportunity. Now, in full disclosure, I am a member of Merck's male population Gardasil advisory board, and I was in a meeting of that board 5 days ago, and I came out of that meeting saying, "Gee, you know, I think this is a missed opportunity." What I have now learned is that it may be, you could argue, maybe routinization as opposed to a permissive recommendation for men. Some people did argue for, some argued against. The ACIP came out with permissive, but it became very clear from Lori that the committee is open to rapidly evolving data. And so maybe it's something that I would wish they had decided differently last October, but the fact is that new data are going to be coming out. Harrell is going to be part of the data that they will be looking at. And so on. So I put it in question mark as something I was worried about, and I'm less so now than I was a couple of days ago. Genital herpes prevention, in general, I think there's been this incredible discrepancy. And the problem with herpes is that the true biological morbidity is low for most people. The psychosexual morbidity is very high. And how do we position that? How does that rank in our priorities? Now, I'm even leaving aside the whole issue of HSV as an HIV transmission accelerator, and just thinking of the fact that I'm not sure that we have the right balance. I would say, in particular, the neonatal herpes, I'm quite sure we don't have the right balance. And I find this, many of you know that I worked on this during my first tour as visiting scientist at CDC in the late 1990s, and I was frustrated by the status, not of the people here who worked on it and cared about it, but if you think about it, this is the same disease, for practical purposes, in its severe form, as neonatal rubella, the whole TORCHES acronym, toxoplasmosis, rubella, herpes, syphilis, et cetera, cytomegalovirus is in there. It's essentially the same disease biologically. Rubella used to be an epidemic disease with many more cases some years than others, but the peak years had 400 cases of congenital rubella. 400 is the low end of the estimate for the frequency of neonatal herpes. And yet, as a nation, we went to a routine childhood immunization program with all of its expense and so on, in order to prevent that number of bad outcomes, because Lord knows German measles in kids is not nearly as severe as rubeola, real measles. And I guess, harking back now to Ned Hook's theme in his parent award talk 2 years ago, emphasizing the importance of sexual health, and that and is now an important theme at ASHA and the Division of STD Prevention and the Center, Kevin, are looking at sexual health as a critical and intended focus. But putting it in that context, I would ask, where is the outrage on neonatal herpes? If sexual health doesn't mean having healthy babies that can be avoided due to an STD, then what does it mean? Does anybody believe for a second that it isn't sex and the fact that it's a sexually transmitted infection that hasn't influenced the difference in national approaches between rubella and neonatal herpes? It has to be part of the question. Now, don't get me wrong. The answer's not easy. The cost, the ability, the test performance to prevent neonatal herpes is not a trivial issue. My outrage is that nobody is doing anything. I mean, if I can't convince the world at large, so I guess that's my plea to you. Think about this as the ultimate outcome of the innocent in STD prevention. And then a final example I'll give is one that everybody cites, knows, understands. But the STD treatment guidelines have been, and always have been, for at least the last 20 or 30 years, the single most visible and arguably, by many standards, the most important outcome of the Division of STD Prevention. And there have been two lapses in how those guidelines are used. Number one, the guidelines themselves have not been evaluated. Talk about translational research, understanding the behavioral determinants of how providers understand guidelines, use them, don't use them, or not. Nobody's done any research whatsoever for practical purposes on what the effect of the guidelines is, how could they be made better, and do we know that they're being followed, and if not, why and how can we improve it? And every 4 years, there is a set of research questions that come up. And although opportunistically, I'm sure many of those research questions that have come up over the years have been addressed, there's certainly been rarely a systematic look to say, gee, here are the recommendations. We spent all this money, time, and energy to bring in 40 or so outside experts to forge these guidelines. They pointed out all the following gaps in why their guidelines are less secure than we would like. Where are we with them? So, I was going to go through these slides and highlight each of these as we spoke of them, but I didn't do it that way. I just left the original slides up. I now finish with my acknowledgement and thanks. No person has influenced my career and my success more than King Holmes. It's almost getting to be a tired cliche to hear King lauded, but I can't not do it. It is my belief that ASTDA should consider creating the King K. Holmes Award, making King the first awardee. In my opinion, King's productivity far outshines anything Thomas Paine ever did. Thomas Paine had a wonderful impact. He was an extremely important C. Everett Koop of his day. But if you look at the CV and look at where we are now compared to where we were 30 years ago and who led that effort, King stands at the pinnacle. In my vision, the King K. Holmes Award would be given first to King. It would be awarded irregularly, every 5 years, every 10 years, only when somebody who came close to matching his accomplishments approached the end of his or her career and then would receive that. So my thanks to King are unmeasurable. The next three people stand almost equally high in my esteem. I'm getting emotional talking about Walt. I miss him terribly, and his professional accomplishments in our field were unexcelled. Had he survived his unfortunate early demise 3 months ago, he would be my first candidate for the next King K. Holmes Award after King's. Larry Corey has been a bright and shining light in my career. All that I learned about viral STDs came directly or indirectly through Larry. And I've talked about my transformation of my attitude and understandings of behavioral and social sciences in STD prevention. And I've already mentioned Sevgi, and she is the source, directly or indirectly, of all that I learned and all that I know, and of that shift in my own career direction and understanding, and I thank her for that. These 10 people are the ones who I have most frequently turned to, apart from the ones you've already seen, when I had clinical questions, epidemiologic questions, when I was too lazy to go to literature and wanted to know the quick and dirty answer. And even when you go to literature, you want the insight of people like Tom Quinn and Ned Hook and Sheila Lucart, Connie Kellum, Matt Golden, Ginny Marazzo, Bob Wood. For those of you who don't know Bob, Bob was, until he retired a few months ago, for 30 years, the director of HIV AIDS prevention in Seattle, King County. Judy Wasserheit, you all know very well. Case Rietmeyer, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, has become another important touchstone both on behavioral science and operational research. Julie Schachter and Dave Martin, of course, in chlamydial infections. And then finally, rather than just listing all the names in writing, I just show pictures of all of those who both have positively influenced my career and for whom I had or could find pictures. And I won't take the time to read all the names, but I'll leave this slide up for a few seconds more and then the next one so that you can, and many of you know these people. Those of you who don't know them, ask your neighbor. We'll make the slides available. And here's another round of some more of those folks. The other group that I will mention, four people here. Barbara Kreckler, number four in the second row, is here in the audience, and so are Victory, the middle three in the last row, Victory Murphy, Irene King, and Sue Szabo. They happen to be here, and so I was able to take pictures of them. But they really are, in these photos, they represent 30 years worth of clinicians, disease intervention personnel, clerical staff, counselors, researchers who have peopled the Seattle King County Public Health STD Clinic over the years, and their involvement in my career and my successes is also unmeasured. And finally, I do thank my family. Ned told you that I am devoted beyond words to them all. What we have here is Laura Hansfield with her husband, Craig Lundstrom. Laura is assistant professor of education at Illinois State University. Craig is an academic geologist at University of Illinois. Nate Lundstrom, on Laura's right, is age 7, my bright and shining blonde dynamo grandson. Evan, next to Craig, is here in the room and came from Champaign to spend time learning that Grandpa Hunter isn't only just a fun grandpa, although he always aspires to be that. I'll talk about Patricia in a minute. Mark Salter and Kate McIntyre. Kate is Patricia's daughter. Mark is Mark and Kate's son is Rowan. Some of you heard stories about Rowan's early months when he was born early some years ago, and at age 4 and a half is doing absolutely wonderfully. Mark is on the faculty assistant professor, about to be associate, is that right? At the University of Ottawa in political science, and Kate is the chief executive officer of an international, of an Ottawa-based NGO that works on international women's rights issues. Four PhDs in the kids. Jim Hansfield, some of you know, is with the reorganization now in the center in NCID, and is a biostatistician epidemiologist, has been here at CDC for some years. Marcy is his wife, and Eagle Scout Matthew is just in the process of learning the multiple choices he will have to school, and most recently Dr. Martin has learned that he's been offered a $15,000 academic scholarship at Tulane, where he will end up, remains to be seen. I do want to stress, as important as this award from you is to me, that this award is in its own way more important. So a year ago in fourth grade, Evan was asked to write an essay on his favorite relative. Evan beats me in Scrabble, and I'm pretty good in Scrabble. And here he is beating me a year or so ago in Hawaii. And one quote from the bottom of this essay is here. One time he surprised me when I woke up one morning and I suddenly saw him sitting on my staircase. I was so happy I felt like a box of Legos had just fallen out of the sky. Now, what better accolade can that possibly be? Those are just some of the reasons that my Grandpa Hunter is my favorite relative. And I love you all very much. And finally, and unequivocally, my wife, Patricia. Many of you know Patricia professionally as well as personally. When I was being promoted to professor at the University of Washington, Ward Cates wrote a letter on my behalf. And Ward does something that I have now done myself from time to time and sent me a copy of the letter blindly, that it had some additional words in it that were intended to be. And among those words were that among Dr. Hansfield's primary accomplishments and the real reason for success was his wisdom in meeting, wooing, and marrying Patricia McIntyre. And that was so true that I didn't realize it was a joke. And she really is my best part. I love you. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate your coming. Thank you so much, Hunter. Well deserved.